Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to today's podcast segment. We welcome Mr. Jay Herman. He is the managing director at a leading cybersecurity firm known as BorderHawk. They are based just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Jay, thanks for your time. Let's go ahead and get started.
Hey, Robbie, thank you. Ready to go.
Yeah, no problem. Here we go. Yeah, we looked up your bio, did some background snooping on you, and you have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career, some big moments, and how you kind of got into cyber?
Absolutely. So I got into cybersecurity right after 2005. I was probably in it in a different way. I think a lot of us, you know, are concerned about protecting our privacy, and especially when we go online and that kind of thing. But in 2005, my wife and I had an identity theft that led to some $1 million worth of fraud, most of it real estate related. And so we ended up with the FBI involved and all kinds of, you know, panicking moments relative to that. Took about 6 months really to clean it up, 400 hours in that 6 months of my personal time. And then we really didn't have any closure in terms of, you know, who did it, how they did it, you know, what happened and that, you know, so on. But when it was over, I realized a couple things. One is all the 400 hours did for me was get it cleaned up. It didn't help me protect myself from a loss of data or identity theft in the future. And so I ended up having some conversation with the ID protection and monitoring companies that were in place at the time, and started asking my own clients. I was in technology and began asking my own clients, you know, what do you guys do to protect this, any sensitive data that you require or collect on people? And what I found was, you know, some people could give you a very convincing answer, and some people didn't sound like they had ever thought about it. And so it led me into wanting to learn more about information security, and that led to, you know, ultimately bidding on some opportunities and winning them, and then that led to the creation of BorderHawk with some other people.
Wow. So were you able to find the perpetrators even to this day after your ID theft situation?
Never, not a word. Now, we had a couple of conversations with the FBI, and then that was it. My wife carried a card around with her a year or two that just said, if you get pulled over and somebody that the law enforcement agency that pulls you over thinks you're the bad guy, give them our card and they'll call us and we'll confirm it's you and you can be on your way. Nothing. She never got pulled over and never had any problems, and we went on about our business. But nope, never had any closure on that. And but we did have, you know, we did learn a lot.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. It really sounds like it, you know, it was just a lot to go through. But now you kind of told us how you ventured into BorderHawk. Now, is this a company that you kind of helped start on your own, or do you have other people, partners helping out with this too?
Yeah, so I helped start it. It's a service-disabled, veteran-owned business. It's owned by Steve Akridge. I helped him start the company back in 2008. But 2007, that's when I was kind of asking all my clients, what do you do, right, to protect our data? And so part of the analysis, call it due diligence for me, was I began looking at state and local government options to bid on security projects, because you could at least learn what entities, organizations were asking the vendor community for help with relative to information security. And so I bid on a couple of those with Steve Akridge and through another company that we were partnered with called Pacific Software Associates out in the West Coast. And we won one of those. And from that, though, Pacific Software Associates ended up going bankrupt right in the middle of our kind of getting things going, which led to stepping back and saying, okay, we know what we're doing, we like what we're doing, we've got ability to help companies, but the entity that we were working through wasn't viable any longer. So So we stepped back, we created Border Hawk, and then went to work in Montana, and we went to work in Alaska from Atlanta, Georgia.
Wow.
So, you know, we decided to go as far away as we could to, you know, have our first customers, apparently. But we still work in Alaska and have an office there or a presence there. And we still have, you know, the bulk of our activities in Cartersville, Georgia, just north of Atlanta.
Cool. Now, I understand the name that you got, Border Hawk, but how did you actually come up with that name? It's a very unique name. Never heard anything like that before.
So everybody, for the most part, everybody that's involved in Border Hawk has a military background. I do, but it's indirect. My dad was in the military. My son is in the military, but I wasn't. And but Border Hawk, the idea behind Border Hawk was, as an organization, you should define your borders and watch them like a hawk, right? So define your borders, watch them like a hawk. There is a drone component out there that we have nothing to do with that I believe has the name Border Hawk. But for us, it was that border. Understand who you are, what your boundaries are, and then how do you monitor and detect activity against that might be happening against you.
Okay, excellent.
You still
now,
with
how
me?
Long have you guys
okay.
been? Yeah. How long have you guys been in business?
The business formed in 2008.
Okay. Now,
11 years.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well, too? Or are you just mostly U.S.-based focused?
Yeah, U.S.-based, U.S.-focused. We have supported clients in other countries, you know, particularly Canada. We have, you know, a Mexico, some of the hotels that have properties around the you know, Caribbean and Canadian environments, but generally speaking, we work with U.S. critical infrastructure related entities. And so there's a lot of entities that fall in that category. And so hotels, as you can imagine, I just mentioned, but we work with trucking and transportation. We work with a fair number of hospitals and healthcare related entities who are under the under HIPAA as the regulatory framework. We do work with a number of power generating oil and gas entities.
Oh.
And then banks, banks and finance, and then some retail. But generally speaking, organizations that fall under critical infrastructure and have a third party regulatory component. In some cases, it's not regulatory, it's industry, like PCI, DSS, could be a industry focus around security, but there's generally some third party that's requiring a level of compliance with a security framework that ends up being part of the relationship that we have with our clients. It's helping them meet that.
Okay. Now, that kind of leads me to another question off the topic here. You said you did work in critical infrastructure. Do you do work with industrial control systems and stuff like SCADA also?
So, yes, with the oil and gas and with the power generating entities, industrial control and SCADA are part and parcel to those industries.
Okay. Now, who's your typical customer base that you're trying to target? You've mentioned your verticals, but are you trying to target the SMBs, the Fortune 500, or perhaps a mixture of both?
Yeah, so we look at, from a targeting perspective, organizations with less than $1 billion in revenue and more than 20 million in revenue. So that's pretty broad, but smaller entities generally can't their approach is to hire someone in house or to outsource the whole thing, and the whole thing might be relatively small, and so not a good fit for us. The under $1 billion, you know, we've got clients that are over that, and we do a lot of work with, you know, state and local government and municipal government, and but what we're looking for is are those entities where We can reach senior management and have a legitimate firsthand relationship with senior leadership so that we can help them really understand the nature of the communication that they as an organization or their organization is making to, say, third parties like regulators or even clients where they sign contracts that say, we will protect your data. And then we can go into the organization and validate that what they're saying is what is happening. Or we can go into their environment and validate that there's risk and that risk needs to be mitigated, and we can explain it back to the leadership team in a way that where we can reach that leadership team personally and have a conversation with them so that we can help them really understand what it is that we're trying to help them solve. And it's going to generally be a very custom type solution because they run their business the way they run their business. And it is a combination of people, process, and technology. When I say it is, I mean security and risk management is a combination of those three things.
Right. Wow, that's an interesting catch on cybersecurity that we never thought of it that way before. Now, let's dive into your product and service line. It seems like that you've got distinct lines in the, I think, cybersecurity maturity consulting, outsourced cybersecurity, mm-hmm. Risk recognition testing, OverWatch, and then your cyber ops, cyber 911. If you could kind of go over each of those in more detail, but especially the security maturity, the risk recognition, I never heard of that exactly before. We all keep hearing about pen testing, OverWatch,
right.
And your cyber special ops. If you can elaborate on a little bit more on those, that'd be awesome.
Absolutely. So cybersecurity maturity consulting came about when, so part of what I just mentioned is lots of organizations tend to look at how can I address security by buying a product or implementing a product or even implementing a service from a third party. And although that may be a part of it, it's a piece of the puzzle. It isn't the entire thing. And so what happens is a lot of organizations are very ad hoc at their information security strategy level. So what I mean by that is they're not following a model. Their teams are very busy doing very specific, probably very valuable things. And if somebody were to go after their organization against that thing that they're doing, might have a tough time. But the reality is that the bad guy or even an accident, it tends to occur when you have when somebody hits on or focuses on your weakness, not your strength. And so a lot of companies don't recognize their weaknesses because they don't look at their activity around their program development against a standardized or a model. So standardized models like NIST has 800.53, 800.171 that you see DFARS and CMMC using. You have HIPAA, which refers back to 800.53 and has the HIPAA security and privacy and breach and audit rules. And then you have PCI, which has their own framework. And so the question is, how do you compare yourself against any, you choose your framework, and can you really go through that framework and say, here's where we compare, and here's where our colleagues compare? So are we as mature as our colleagues or in our industry, or are we not? And if we're not, do we need to be? Are we different? And is there a reason that we don't need to do X, Y, or Z? Or are we just not investing the energy and the money to become mature? And so that's really kind of where the maturity model effort comes from. It's a proactive measure. A lot of organizations end up being audited, whether that's a SOC Type 2 audit. We mentioned healthcare. If the OCR comes in and does an audit because there was a breach of PHI, or a NERC entity, a power generating entity gets audited by NERC. That's a snapshot of you relative to your maturity, but it's generally a not a knee-jerk, but an ad hoc piecemeal, a moment in time focused audit. And the audit is to see, do you do what you say you're doing, right? Or do you have a comprehensive view of the risk associated with your organization's activities? Do you have policy, which is issued by leadership, you will, you shall, you must type statements that then flow down into procedures that the organization's resources, HR, for instance, says, hey, here's our policy. We will, we shall protect sensitive data. Okay. Well, do we know where our sensitive data is? If we know where our sensitive data is, and some of it is even greater, has greater sensitivity than others. For instance, a lot of organizations work in the area of public trust. So then you would hire people with a clear background. So they would, you would say, hey, in order to meet that policy sensitive data that is of a public trust, then we need to hire people who are going to handle that data and have a background check on criminal and credit, for instance, possibly. That may be your answer. And we're only going to put people into that, into roles that handle that data that have passed that background check. And so that's part of your policy. Well, if you say you do that, but you don't do that, then that's a level, that's an immature, right, approach to part of what you're doing. What leadership is saying they're doing is not being met by what the people are actually doing. So it's a management and leadership irreconciliation. So part of that maturity model is to go through and go through all these kinds of activities of risk identification and actually comparing them to, okay, what does ISO 27001 say that we should do in this area? Let's go back to disposal of sensitive data. You know, so they have a destruction, they have a records retention approach, they have backup disaster recovery approaches that all have impact on that. And so if you're just managing it, in other words, you've got really smart people doing really good things, it's hard to measure what you're doing against what an industry standard says you ought to be doing. And so the maturity model is purposefully going down the road of picking the framework that you want to live by, and then embedding that into the decisions that are made into the company, and how you prove to yourself that you're meeting that, so that no matter what kind of audit comes down the line, a lawsuit, a third party vendor, it comes back and says, you said you were going to do these things, but we say you aren't. Or the government comes in through a OCR or FTC and they say, hey, we want to audit you. Or, you know, you go through a SOC Type 2. Your response to an information technology risk audit should be pretty much the same no matter what the rationale behind the audit, because you should be living in a way that produces the environment that allows you to be subject to the audit with no change, because it's what you do every day anyway. You're just producing evidence to the auditor that this is what you do. But in a lot of cases, what happens is the audit reveals they're not doing the work. And absolutely, what we've seen under HIPAA and the OCR has been the idea of a risk assessment has been part and parcel to the approach forever, ever since HIPAA came about. But one of the biggest, falling away of the CMS says and the OCR say is that a valid risk assessment is almost never done, or is very often not done, and so it really hurts organizations. And so all that tends to flow into the selection of a framework and the commitment by leadership to build in that maturity into their organization and use a framework as a model to do it.
Okay, excellent. Now, have you done any work? Now, I think the big buzzword here is the CMC. Now, I've talked to a bunch of people just in the last week, about two or three. In fact, I just had a guest on a podcast Saturday where one of his big service lines is in doing that certification. Have you done any work with that? I mean, as far as I know, it's just kind of like all talk right now. There just hasn't been much movement yet, but it's really going to be coming down. I think it's where the DOD has mandates that their contractors have to have the certification. Are you certified,
right,
or have you done any work in this kind of area?
Well, so first of all, no organization is yet certified by the Department of Defense or the CMMC body, right? They're still building out their information security model, and they have not invited vendors to become part of a certification process as of yet. Up until now and currently, if you're a DoD vendor who handles CUI, so controlled unclassified information, then you have self-attested that you meet a certain level, and there are five levels. So you've told the CMMC board or the DoD that you have looked at yourself and you're a level one, or you've looked at yourself and you're a level two or three. And what that means is that when a bid is put out by the DoD, then they are going to say this bid requires certification to a CMMC level X, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. And if you are X or greater, then you can bid on it. If it says 3 and you are 2 or 1, you will not be able to bid on it. And so up until now, you've been doing self-assessment, self-attestations that you meet the requirements of level 1, which is pretty straightforward, or level 2, which jumps up a good bit. Level 3 is getting close to 130 controls, and level 4 and 5 get way on up into 250-some-odd controls, as far as I recall. But no one is certified today to be a CMMC auditor, but there are plenty of companies who are saying, hey, the CMMC is telling us in October bids are going to start coming out and the certification is going to be required, so we need to get ready. So that maturity model audit, that maturity model consulting I was telling you about, we do that, and we do assist companies who are themselves preparing to go before an audit. And so there's two groups of people that you're talking about. There's the group of people who are going to become the auditors. We don't know who they are yet. Then there are the group of people who are currently DoD vendors, or who will become DoD vendors, and they have to have their organization assessed by an audit firm, pair them to the CMMC levels 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, right? And so when they do that, they're going to get their assessment back, and they're either going to make it or they're not. And if they don't make it, let's say they need to make it to a level 3, and they don't meet that, but they make a level 2, then they're going to have to begin working on their organization to strengthen their security posture to get to a level 3, and they will not be able to receive contracts that are level 3 or higher until they do. Okay, so that's and we do help companies do that today.
Okay. Awesome. Now, are your services, are they mostly like available in the cloud, like the AWS or Azure, or do you actually do like on-site assessments? And right now, given the coronavirus pandemic right now, do you just do everything remotely now, or what's the situation like for you?
So primarily, we do our assessments on-site. And the reason for that is that you learn a lot by looking around, right? So a in the cloud assessment only can serve a great purpose and can be very effective, but the ability to sit across from the person that you're doing the assessment with and to literally walk through. So let's say that they have a data center. The data center has protected health information in it, and they need to limit the number of people that come in and out of that data center. So we're gonna walk up to it and expect to see a lock on the door, right? And a log that's booked that says that so and so came in on this day at this time and they left at this day and this time. And we're gonna expect to see that there are maybe they're not sprinkler heads right above the servers, right, from the fire extinguishing suppression system. We're going to be looking to see if the walls go all the way to the ceiling through the drop, ceiling tiles all the way to the top, or could somebody literally crawl over the top and drop down in and get access to the environment? So some of that stuff you cannot tell without being on site, and some of it you just have to, And so like right now, we would go on site. We might not interact with a lot of people, the social distancing, but if we were really going to do an assessment, we could do a big chunk of it and not be on site. Part of an assessment has to do with what we call soft data, so policies, procedures, video or pictures of your environment and logs and things like that. We can do interviews over the phone. And you could use things, webcasting tools and video tools and so on. But and if push came to shove and that's all you had, then that's all you have. You still got to get it done. But if it's at all possible for us to be on site, we would prefer to be on site at least to do a walkthrough. Walk in the front door, walk out the back door, and look at some things along the way. And so, so you said, is our services in the cloud or in person? So all of our consulting services for risk assessment can be conducted through a cloud-based platform or through us being on site at least some of the time. And the cloud-based platform that we talked about is the OverWatch tool that we mentioned a while ago. And so I'll skip the cyber risk recognition testing for a second and tell you a little bit about OverWatch. And so, we have a little byline that we like to use, and it says, the digital world punishes. And so obviously what we mean by that is if take the recent COVID-19 response to all the sheer volume of workers working from home and using Zoom. And this is not against Zoom, nothing negative here about Zoom, but the phrase Zoom bombing became known because people were passive in terms of understanding what could happen to a Zoom webcast or conference call. And so they didn't know that they should start and host the video and then allow people in that they knew and then shut it off. In terms of not allowing anyone else to automatically join once the conference started. So what happened was people were online, they had conferences, and people with bad intent logged in and took over and knew how to use Zoom, and they kicked out the good people, and or not necessarily good people, but the people who were supposed to be there, and took over until they just shut down the conference, or the conference host regained control. And then everybody learned how to set up the security on their Zoom. So that's an example of what we mean by the digital world punishes the passive. You should go through those exercises and think, the bad guy, about how your tools might be exploited before you put them into a place where, the world can get access to them. And so in talking about OverWatch and our cloud-based stuff, so we have a tool that we call OverWatch, and it's a business process tool, and it's designed to improve IT risk management and cybersecurity integration. And this, think about this tool as for a CIO, maybe doesn't have a CISO, or maybe has a very technical CISO who's come up in the ranks from an IT perspective. But the CIO says, man, I have to handle people, process, and technology, and my CISO, in this case, or my lack of CISO, is technical, so I don't have the people process. So our OverWatch environment allows the CIO to basically track information risk controls across the organization. So this is back to that maturity model. Do I have in place what I need, and am I doing the things that need to be done to ensure that what I have in place is working and working effectively? And if I do that well, then I can simplify a security audit, no matter who comes at me, right? No matter what organization is going to audit me, I've got the data that I need. It helps me tell leadership where I am managing areas of IT risk and where I'm not. So in other words, is personnel doing a good job, but my third-party vendor risk management, we're not doing a good job. So I know where to focus to get better. It gives me the ability to align these business processes that we have and manage the supply chain risk associated with third parties and the overall information security aspect of our supply chain. And the last thing is it helps relieve labor shortages that are relative to cybersecurity, because I do have the ability to fractionalize and outsource, if I need to, some of the services where a third party could log into my environment and it could actually help me deliver against any of those things I just mentioned. But by doing so, I'm not creating a file cabinet project management system, right? All of the project management activity is inherently in OverWatch in one place. So if I have to go analyze or produce evidence from, I'm not looking in email, I'm not looking in SharePoint, I'm not looking in any of these other tools. I'm looking in this one environment so that I can make sure that I have what I need. Does that help?
Excellent. Now, yeah, that's awesome. Now, what do you feel about the current remote worker situation? I mean, everybody's working from home, and I think a lot of companies did obviously allow some, you know, employees to work remotely, and that's always been, you know, like one of the biggest trends. But given this, now everybody's working from home, and I think companies just weren't ready for this. And I think that kind of comes down to having the right incident response plan and having the right business continuity plan, more importantly. And I think corporate America is now really starting to realize that. So hopefully now they'll have these plans and practice them. But what are your thoughts on that with this work from home issues of like remote monitoring, your corporate edge being blurred, being on the home network, you know, the challenges of the virtual private network? That's one of the safest ways really to log in, but, you know, employees may not really understand that or how to log in properly. And what other challenges have you faced? I mean, have you actually, like, helped clients and prospects resolve this issue or these issues?
So we have. And so one of the things that you know, the whole work – when people talk about work from home, I think that phrase is gonna be short-lived. I think it's going to morph into work from anywhere. And so even the home network, like you mentioned, if a person goes home and they work on their home network and it's the same network that their kids are playing Xbox on, their kids are playing video games on, their kids are doing homework at, you know, and going to, you know, research who knows what sites, and nothing, you know, extraordinary or bad is intended to be happening on that network. You know, what we see is that most home networks have a router. The router is configured and it still has the OEM, you know, password. And so there's no firewall, and there's probably no endpoint security on the computing, the computers on the network, unless it's on, say, the laptop that the employee of some company brought home. And so by being on that network, the risk goes way up. Right. And so, then, of course, you know, people can you could have somebody who could get into your network and actually get involved in, you know, whatever's on your computer when you come home and go back and forth. But the idea that you could use a VPN certainly is a good idea, and it helps. But if the computer that's going to use the VPN, that's going to log into, say, a core accounting system at a corporation, and that computer's already owned, it's already compromised, then the VPN is actually being able to be used in reverse by the bad guy and cloak their activity and conceal their activity as that laptop logs into the home network, communicates out through the VPN and hits the VPN connection at the gateway at the corporate client, then it passes through, and the potential is there and to actually pass through the bad guy along with the good guy, and nobody knows. And so just putting in a VPN and just putting in endpoint security And just doing anything is by in and of itself, those things may be good, but they may not be standalone good. So in other words, you need to look the organization needs to look at the entire environment, including the home environment, and make sure that if it's a case of a person who has a remote login to an application, that's potentially very problematic. If they have a computer that they take home, then the organization could harden that computer, and they could take some, depending on the level of sensitivity, if they've done a risk assessment, and say most of the work that this person with this laptop does is no big deal, and they couldn't hurt anything, and if they did, we can recover, no problem. They could say that, or they could say that the level of risk and sensitivity associated with this worker is different than all these other workers. I want to make sure that when they boot up that computer, the only thing it can do is connect to this application in a secure and hardened manner. And that's challenging. That's hard to do. I mean, it's not hard to do, but it's costly. It's time consuming. You have to have stuff infrastructure in place to support that. But if you've never done a risk assessment and you don't know that, then you don't, You're just saying I got to treat everybody the same who works from home. And in a security world, anytime we say I need to treat everyone the same, we're automatically going to have problems, because what you would do for the vast majority who may or may not be able to access certain things that are sensitive and protective, what you would do for them is very different than what you would do for the few who do have access to the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. And if you don't recognize that, you're going to have a problem. And so that's, you know, what I think is the work from anywhere is going to become more and more important. And when I say that, what I mean is, instead of work from home, the home net, whatever network your computer connects to, is it becomes part of the corporate network. And so that laptop or that device that you're on could be a phone, laptop, iPad, whatever. Their organizations are going to have to say, yes, we support this, and we have remote workers. They work from anywhere. And if they work from anywhere, then we're going to set up a very specific instance and a technology that they can use. And when they use that technology, then they can access our network. And we'll validate them when they hit our network in a sandbox or a quarantined area. And once they pass that validation, then we'll allow them to connect to the application or the infrastructure that they need to do their job. And today, most companies are just saying, like, I've got clients who go, well, we have RDP, Remote Data Protocol, built into our computer, so we just use that. And I'm like, okay, well then, you know, can I talk to you a little bit about why that could be a problem? And they're like, well, sure, but they don't intend to do anything about it. And so they are just accepting the level of risk that without really understanding it or doing anything else about it. So I think we're going to go through a wave that we have not seen yet. We're all familiar with the flattening the curve and the pushing out the timeline relative to COVID-19, but work from home related issues, we're going to see similar responses, because people are going to get ransomware from their house. They're going to get malware from their house. They're into the corporate network. They're going to have ACH and wire fraud attempts occur that they trace back and go, that bad guy got into our ACH process from someone's home. And that's going to happen. It probably already has happened, and the inability to detect things like that occurring is so prevalent. Most companies cannot detect that something bad's happening on their network, that it's probably already happened, and we just don't know it yet. You know, and so we'll start hearing about that here pretty soon, as the months wear on with workers working from home. Expect to see the crystal ball, right? I don't really have one, but expect to see. The stories come in, and the FBI come out and say, hey, we've seen a rise in, or, you know, Ponemon come out and say, hey, we've seen a rise in these work from home issues. And I think it's, I think we're not putting that, you know, that genie back in the bottle. I think organizations are going to leverage work from anywhere strategies, but the ones that do it successfully are going to spend some time and say, okay, who's working from home or anywhere? What are they working from? In other words, is it a Linux box? Is it a Windows box? Is it a Microsoft, an Apple box? Is it an iPad? How are they connecting to our network, and how can we validate that there's nothing inherent in that connection that we don't want in there? And they're going to have to go through that process and set that up, and it's going to be considered a little bit of a pain for the users. And so I believe the ones that consistently do well will go through that process and enforce that as part of their maturity model that we talked about earlier.
Okay. Well, Jay, this part of our conversation brings up three more questions, if you don't mind me asking that. The issue of bring your own device, I mean, you say work from anywhere. Are companies going to allow employees to kind of use their own devices now?
I think they do already.
Zoom. Really?
Yeah, so there's definitely two camps, right? So there's some that say, we're going to issue you a computer and we're going to send it to you. And then there are others that say, hey, you know what? We're going to set up a login to an application. And you, as long as you can access that application with that login on a browser, you're good to go, right? And both of those have you know, particular challenges that need to be overcome. But, you know, to say I've got a browser and I haven't done things to harden that browser or to configure that browser so that it's, you know, it's not saving cookies forever. It's not doing, you know, different things that we might just allow it to do if we could, or forcing the use of a certain browser. Some browsers are better at privacy and security out of the gate than others. And so I think we'll see people definitely, I already have lots of clients who do not care what computer you use to access a resource they have, especially if that resource is in the cloud. And there's a right. fundamental belief that if it's in the cloud, it's whoever's hosting it in the cloud, AWS, Rackspace, Google, is somehow securing it. And that is a myth, right? And now you might hire those companies to add layers of security in. For instance, AWS, if you set up the environment correctly, and you're a healthcare provider or a business associate, they will sign a business associate agreement with you that is very limited, but at least they will, and they tell you exactly how to set that instance up, that AWS instance up, so that it's as secure as they're going to stand, you know, provide any kind of standing for. But the reality is that in most cases, the cloud provider is providing you access to an environment, and it is up to you, the company that you know that you are, to secure that environment. It is at least up to you to understand what they provide. And so I see a lot of companies who say, you know, we're just going to put it in the cloud, and then as long as our client, you know, our employee can get to it, we're good. And that's gonna bite companies, but I do believe that the ability to use your own device, you know, bring your own device is already in play, because just think about your phone. Almost no employer provides you a second phone. You use the same phone with the same browser, with the same technology, and the same email and the same network card to get on and off the network, no matter where you are, with very few exceptions. And some of those exceptions are, you know, obvious, and some of them wouldn't be so obvious. But yeah, I think that bring your own device is already out there. It's already in play in such a significant portion of the population that, you know, that it's going to continue.
Okay. Now, Are there any other alternatives than Zoom that you recommend to clients? I mean, there's like WebEx and Microsoft Teams. Is there anything else that you would recommend to people who are going to be working from home or work from anywhere for that matter?
You know, I don't know that any of those individual tools are better than the other. What really matters is the people that are hosting those environments and ensure that they understand, you know, the biggest weakness in any computing system from a security perspective is the human involved with the computer. And so as long as organizations have employees who just download an app and install it and run with it, they're going to experience problems. If they engage in effective and varied and consistent training around security, and then they, and let's say they have work from home and they say, hey, we're gonna approve, Zoom, WebEx, GoToMeeting, Slack, and whoever competes with them, Signal, but in order to use them, you must go through the following settings and make the following changes, and things like that are going to become more and more normal. Or the company is going to say, we approve one of these, and they're going to push out an instance of that environment that updates it to make it conform to the security standard that the companies are comfortable with, right? And so they're going to say, if you're going to use these tools, you're going to use them with the following security provisions in place.
Okay. Now, just one last thing here. I've been here reading a lot of stories about the RDP, the remote desktop protocol, security issues. Can you kind of elaborate more on that, like what you've seen with that? In fact, I think I've even read where RDP is even banned from some companies.
RDP is banned in some cases, but the problem is RDP is part of the operating system. It's used. So one of the challenges with Microsoft and others is that the operating system may actually support information security capabilities, but by and large, those capabilities are not enabled and turned on when the product ships. And so most people are uncomfortable going into regex or going into the guts of the system and making changes because they don't necessarily know what those changes are going to ripple effect out to. And so they don't do anything. And so RDP, UPnP, Universal Plug and Play, mice, there's numbers of little processes that are and enabled by default that are security red flags, that are concerns. And RDP is one of those. It's part of the inherently part of the operating system. It's designed to make connection and remote takeover of a computer essentially easy. So I'll give you an example. My mother-in-law has a computer, and a couple of times now, she's had a situation where, you know, the screen popped up and said, hey, call this number. You know, we're Microsoft, and you have a virus, and the only way to get rid of this virus is to call us, and we're going to get rid of it. And so she did that. She called them, and they weren't Microsoft. They went into her computer. She gave them access. And they altered her environment. They actually created a super user on her computer and then modified out where you couldn't see any other user, and then said, in order to get your computer back, you're going to have to pay us $300. And she said no and hung up, right? Well, then she couldn't get her computer back. So I had to, you know, get involved, go, you know, literally boot up to a Linux environment, get rid of the super user, build her profile back, and get her system back and going. I was like, you should have paid him the $300 because it would have cost me a lot less. But the idea there is that RDP is the avenue that they can tell it's running on that server, and as soon as they give you that link, and you're an unsuspecting user, a victim, then they're able to execute over the RDP and potentially other protocols as well, but RDP is built in, and here they know that this lady, you know, is elderly, and she's, you know, she likes to use her computer, but she's not a computer savvy person, and they took advantage of her twice, and so now, I run a virtual machine on her computer, and she accesses her computer through a virtual machine that I control. So, right, we don't have that capability on her computer, and she runs as a guest, not as administrator. And so we've tried to create several layers where she can't be taken advantage of just because she's not savvy. And so so there are tools like that that people could use, but RDP could potentially be run even in guest mode and still cause problems. So RDP in and of itself in a commercial environment, I think is a no-go, but I do have clients who use it and they are unwilling to invest in a more effective communications tool.
Wow.
You have to live with it, right? I can't, I'm an advisor and it's ethically my job and the job of people at BorderHawk and others like us to tell our client what we think and what the cost, the ramifications are. Or the implications are, but at the end of the day, we have to support their decision, whatever that is.
Right. Wow, I didn't realize. That sends some shivers down my spine, the story you just said. Wow. Okay, well, let's go into another part of the cybersecurity threat landscape here, and that's security versus compliance. Now, I think a lot of people kind of think the two go together, and there's reason for that. But in your opinion, mm-hmm. what are the key differences between the two of them?
So the key difference between compliance and security are the drivers, right? So generally speaking, compliance is a driver to an organization to show that they're doing things according to back to that model, to some kind of security model. And so, you know, healthcare has lots of information of security compliance officers. Very often, they're attorneys. The attorney may be a privacy officer as well. And so what they're looking to do is to say, hey, are we compliant with what HIPAA's asked for? And so that process is very quantitative, meaning you can look and say, do we have a process for disaster recovery, business continuity, or records retention, or protection of PHI in our email. You know, do we have a DLP? Yes. We have all those things, and so at surface, we are compliant. We actually do what the security is a subjective assessment of risk, or it should be looked at through that lens. And so for security, for risk to exist, you have to have two things. You have to have a vulnerability and a threat against an asset. So first of all, there has to be an asset, right? So the corporate network is an asset, PHI is an asset, your laptop's an asset, ACH money in your bank account is an asset. So you have to have an asset. And then the question becomes, okay, is there a threat? So if there's no threat and you have done nothing to improve against your two systems and completely vulnerable, but there's nobody and nobody cares, then there's no vulnerability, right? So there's no threat and there's high vulnerability, gold sitting in the field. But then you say, oh, somebody just walked up and they don't have a wheelbarrow, they don't have a truck, they don't have any means, you know, now I've got a threat. They can take some of my gold, but they might not be able to get all of it. So am I okay with them stealing some before I do something about it? And then you go through, okay, I'm going to put up a 3-foot fence and that's a deterrent. I'm going to put up a 5-foot fence and that's a little bit harder. I'm going to put up a 10-foot fence with razor wire. Okay, now I'm pretty serious. But, you know, I've got a drone and it's big enough to come over and pick up my whole stack of gold. I've still got, so this equation between risk and threat. If my vulnerability increases and my threat decreases, I'm in a good shape. But if my vulnerability increases and my threat increases, I'm in a bad shape. Some things are worth less than others. And so if if I have a public-facing website that's got static catalog information and it's good for people to validate, but we don't do business on it, and somebody defaces it or takes it down, it's bad, but it's not terrible. If somebody gets into my system that runs my payroll and steals all my payroll money, like happened to the city of Tallahassee through a vendor six months or so ago, then you have a problem. You know, either you have that money sitting in the bank to replenish that money, or you have an insurance policy to replenish that money or something. But the idea from a security perspective, that's different than compliance. Compliance does not go through the exercise of a definition of risk, the sum of vulnerability times threat, right? And so from a security perspective, you go through your organization and you think like a bad guy about all your stuff. And then you build all this stuff into play to protect it. And then you report that to compliance, who looks at it from a little bit different picture. They're both important, right? They look at it from a different picture and say, now I'm going to communicate to the outside world in a way that doesn't necessarily reveal my keys to the kingdom from a security perspective. So I'm not increasing my risk because I'm telling people too much. I'm sharing with them what they need to know so that they will continue to trust us. So compliance is a lot about trust, and security is all about risk and risk management, which leads to trust. Does that make sense?
Yep, makes perfect. In fact, this is the first time I think I've even asked that question. You're the first guest that's actually brought the topic up. I'm glad you cleared it up for our audience here. Now, you know, there's a lot of legislation out there. I think the two most notoriously known ones are the GDPR and the CCPA, which was just recently passed in California. Now, I've heard of organizations that the financial penalties is like their key driver to become compliant, and I've read where a lot of companies are still compliant. And what will make a company, other than the financial the penalties, what will make them drive to become compliant with these legislations? I mean, I just don't think they quite understand the ramifications of being hit by a cyber attack, because they think, well, it's not happened to me. It's not, you know, if it hasn't happened to me, it's never going to happen, right? So how do we make, you know, corporate America more proactive when it comes to compliance? I mean, to me, being fined, you know, 4% of gross revenue is a very scary thing, you know?
Well, it is, and I do think that you're right. Most companies don't, you know, when you look at GDPR and you go, okay, well, I'm a U.S. company and I do business with U.S. people. So the likelihood that an individual is going to walk in my shop and I'm going to do business with them, I'm going to lose their data or they're going to ask me to forget them, right, because that's a right that they have. And then I do or I don't, and then they have an identity theft or whatever, and they attribute it to me, that the court in Europe is going to be able to reach over across the ocean and hurt me. Now, I know that there are, you know, there are legal gateway, you know, partnerships, not partnerships, but, and I just went blank on the phrase that I was looking for, but there are mechanisms in place for that to occur. But the likelihood that a small business in the U.S. is going to get seriously hurt by the GDPR is challenging to digest, although it's possible. And now bigger companies, and let's say you're a hotel, you're a hospitality entity, and you don't know who's walking through the front door, and your guests are transient in the first place. Now, okay, you might have a greater exposure right out of the gate just because of who your audience is, who your customer is. CCPA is a little different, although not tremendously, in that it's still in California. And the challenge with in the U.S. is jurisdiction. So, you know, Massachusetts citizens and Florida citizens and California citizens, they are all protected by their own states, home states' view and legislation around data protection of the citizen. And so it's really a very confusing, you know, quilt of all kinds of different patches that each state has of their own. And so CCPA is certainly a challenging one. I think, you know, on some levels it's a step in the right direction, but it's only, and on some levels it probably didn't go far enough. But your question is, if a fear of fine isn't enough to drive adoption of these information security frameworks, because conversation, if a company picked a framework, ISO 27001 or NIST 853 or 800-171, or there's like 80 frameworks, pick one, compare yourself to it, and live up to that framework, odds are you would be almost all the way home on any legislation in any country, save things like right to forget and things like that that are unique in GDPR. Any of these frameworks, if you really adhere to them, you would be able to pass almost all aspects of an audit of the CCPA, of the New York City CCRR. You'd be able to pass the Florida Information Protection Act. You would end up being able to pass any of these state attorneys' efforts to validate their legislation against you, because you've actually built it into the way that you run your organization. And that's the difference. Until companies start doing that, then these framework, these regulatory compliance issues are going to keep popping up, because companies are being looked at as if they're not stewarding, they're not protecting the relationship, the stewardship relationship that they have with the individual's information in a way that makes the home state feel like that by and large companies are doing a good job. So even the federal government and the FTC and the OCR, they're all in the same game. Department of or the OIG, the Inspector General, they're all in the same game of saying we can't expect, or we don't expect, that companies are going to do the depth of the right things that they should do on their own. So we're going to create these legislative mandates that, so when they don't do it and it hurts one of our citizens, we can punish them. And even if they don't want to punish them, that's still the hammer that they have, you know. And so as companies, if every company literally sat back and said, you know what, I don't want to be subject to the whims of the California State Attorney General and the CCPA. And so what I want to do is I want to build an information security program that's rigorous enough and strong enough that if I got accused, if we became a defendant in a case, then with the CCPA or GDPR or anybody else, then we can take and invite the auditor from that entity in and show them what we do. And we're going to be greater than 95% whole when that audit is done. And the only things that are going to be different are things that we thought that we looked at and our rationalization of what is reasonable. We made a decision to do A, and the auditor thinks we should have done C. Okay, auditor is going to walk through the door and how they feel today. So I'm going to run my business based on these realities that we control and that we made decisions of. And that's where, you know, using a framework, comparing yourself against that framework from a maturity model will ultimately help the business survive any audit. But I believe it will help them get more business, because the day is here when third parties are saying, and I'm part of this almost every day, we want to do business with you, but if you don't prove to me and answer these 20 to 200 questions from a security perspective, we're not doing business together. And if I don't like your answers, I may ask you to actually build in greater security in order to do business with me. And so the friction that it creates in a sales environment, I think, is more damaging than the potential for the fine, because the fine may or may not ever occur, but the sales environment is occurring over and over and over and over. And if it takes longer, that it's going to hurt you. You're going to lose deals.
Well, okay. Let's kind of segue back to your company here a little bit. Why should someone come to you? I mean, there are probably 2,000, 3,000 cyber vendors just here in the U.S., lots of startups. Why should a customer come and say, hey, Jay, I really want to use your services versus these 2,000 others?
So I think what really matters is that there is a recognition of people, process, and technology. A lot of the vendors that we talk to, and we actually partner with a lot of what would be called MSPs, managed service providers. And what that means when I say we partner with them is that, so for instance, let's say a company sells computers and networks, and they install them and support them, and they sell at Microsoft Azure and Active Directory and all these networking components. And they might say, we build in their security. And they may do all kinds of things to increase the security, just like we would. But they don't deal with the policy and the procedure and the training and the people, and they don't come in and do the risk assessment. They, you know, the idea, a lot of companies think that a vulnerability assessment is the same as a risk assessment. I hear this a lot. Well, we just scanned our network, so we did a risk assessment. No, that's not a risk assessment. If there's not an evaluation across the board, or at least on a specific component of the technology and the process that you're using around threat and vulnerability to equal risk, it's not a risk assessment. If you're running a scan and that scan says this computer has missed this patch and you need to patch it, then that's a good thing, but that's not a risk assessment. And so a lot of people misunderstand what a risk assessment is. And so there are plenty of companies out there like us. And so it becomes one of those things of capacity. We have the OverWatch tool that I mentioned. So if a company says, I don't have a team, in other words, I've got an IT director and a couple of IT people, but I don't have a security team. And let's say they're going to deal with the CMMC, and they have to meet a level 3. And let's say level 3 says that they have to monitor their networks somehow, and they don't have any means to do that. It may be more effective for them to reach out to a company like us who can monitor that system. And we can monitor it all the way from it's a process that we log into their system every day, so we put tools into their environment. It kind of depends on the criticality of the environment and the monetary investment that they feel is appropriate to make. And so we can give them a lot. We can give them advice and guidance on what they need to do to understand so when you're talking about security and what people do to make their environment more secure, generally you're talking about controls. And so when you introduce controls, that a lot of subjectivity can be put into those controls. And so, meaning you could do the same, you could accomplish the same thing multiple ways. So one of the things that a company like us should be able to help with is to evaluate the efficacy and the viability of whatever your control is and whatever your response to meeting that control is. And so if a company can't do that for you, then at least for that purpose, you might want to reach out to somebody who can. So people come to us when they know that they need to be able to build an information security program that can support an audit. People that know that they need to do that, they will come to us. And we will be able to help them. And odds are, you know, no guarantees, because it rides on the ability of the company to digest the activities necessary in the time frame. But companies come to us that say, hey, we really need to understand security, and we really need to understand business, the business aspect of security, and how do we deploy our assets in a way that makes us secure. And so you know, we're not necessarily more unique than hundreds of others, but we're very good at what we do, and we have a tremendously experienced team. Everybody, the core leadership of our team and the core skill set of our consultants, Bates. These are people that have been doing this 30 years. So we're not in this business, 5 years. We weren't driving a truck, a year ago. And we went and got a CISM or a CISSP. These are guys that have been doing it, and we've been doing it in very critical infrastructure environments, and we built a very good reputation in that space. So for that reason alone, that somebody, we find ourselves in the bucket of companies that people talk to, and able, looking for somebody to help them. And so that's generally why people come to us.
Excellent. Wow. Do you have any customer success stories that you share with us, or any client testimonials that you can kind of give some general information about?
We had a customer a couple years ago start with us. We're introduced through a referral. Somebody that knew us called the IT director and said, hey, I know what you guys are going through. You should reach out to them. And so I went to lunch with their IT director. And so what happened, though, in the conversation was this organization is a healthcare entity. They had been reached out to by one of their major insurance company clients. And that client had said, in order to do business with us, and, it's a material, we're a material client to them. That's what the insurance company was saying. In order for you to do business with us, you have to become high trust certified. And high trust is one of those frameworks that's tightly controlled around healthcare. They're making inroads into other places as well. But our client said, we have to be high trust controlled or certified. And so my company does not do certifications today against any framework. We help people do the homework to get there and to achieve certification, but we're not, you can't audit your work, right? So we just don't do it. And so what happened with this customer was they said, we've got PHI all over the place inside of our environment. But when we built our company, we built it with, from production in mind, not security. So we have all these issues. So we came in and we helped them do a risk assessment and identified all the issues that they had, helped them go through that process. And then we built a project plan around how are we going to help you in 18 months go from zero security to high trust certified? How are we going to do that? And so we built a plan and then we acted against that plan. They used several of our resources on a fractional basis, including we provided a CISO 60 hours a month. Because they didn't have a chief information security officer, and about 6 or 8 months in, halfway in anyway, the insurance company came back and said, you know what, we don't need you to meet high trust anymore, but we do need you to go through a SOC 2 audit and give us the passing results of that audit, which is a completely different audit. It's a completely different scope of work. But so midstream, 9 months in, and with 9 months to go from zero, we reconfigured all the work that we were doing for them and the way they tracked the evidence of that work on the SOC 2 controls, introduced them to an accounting firm that could do the SOC 2 assessment for them, and then began, working on their behalf with SOC accounting firm, and they passed their audit first time through. And they did use our tool. We didn't call it Overwatch at the time. It was just an in-house tool that we built to help us manage our customers. But they did use our tool, and that tool got a lot of attention from several accounting firms who do these audits because it really increased the simplicity of that audit. It made everything available to the auditor that they needed in one clear and concise place. And so we were able to cut down the total time, cut down the total cost, and increase the likelihood that they were going to pass, and then they did pass. So that's a recent success story. Still a client, we still work with them on a regular basis because in their case they actually outsourced some of the components of their information security team to us directly. So we provide that work every day for them.
Congratulations. Wow. Well, Jay, as we approach the last, few minutes of our episode here, I just want to ask you a couple more questions. You know, the coronavirus now is front and center in terms of the cyber threat landscape. And, you know, we've talked, you know, about the Zoom bombing and the working from home issues. Mm-hmm. But let's set aside the COVID-ID for a little while. And what do you think, absent the COVID-ID, are some of the biggest cybersecurity threats we're going to see this year? Is it going to be ransomware, BEC, or I think it could be attack on the critical infrastructure. My viewpoint is, you know, if we're having such a hard time handling a pandemic, how are we going to, you know, handle an attack where water supplies could be cut off for weeks, electricity could be cut off for weeks? What do you think is going to be the biggest threat?
Business email compromise is a very lucrative vector. So has ransomware been. We've seen it kind of drop, but it'll come back, I believe. So those are two things that I will say don't expect are going to go away. They were too effective, and really as a group overall, companies haven't really been done what they needed to do to detect and stop those two scenarios. So they're going to continue to be problematic. I think that, you know, we're all concerned about the IoT, the Internet of Things, or the Internet of Everything, and especially its position in critical infrastructure. So, you know, several years ago, we had a client that had some serious interaction with a device that had been modified in a remote power management module. A remote power management module is a device that in this case was part of their data center racks, and the rack had, if you were a system admin and you had servers that were hundreds of miles away from you, but occasionally you wanted to reboot them, then the remote power management module gave you the ability to do that again on the computers that were on a given rack inside a data center. So we had a client who is part of critical infrastructure, began to experience what we'll call noise on their SIM, and so their SIM environment and their SIM staff were detecting this noise, and in the ensuing effort to figure out what it was, they essentially shut down everything in that data center and on those racks, and the noise was still there. And so the outcome of that was we took some of the RPMs, remote power management devices, back to our office and our lab. And of course, they're stamped made in USA, right, all over them. But when you opened them, they had – so think a printed circuit board that a child had soldered a little EEPROM on. Right, in your mind, you know what a printed circuit board looks like. It's very elegant, very clean. It's robotic. It's made by robotic process. But in this case, it was that plus somebody had soldered something on it. And the little device that they soldered something onto it was a EEPROM. And the EEPROM had code in it. And the code had tried to execute. And that was the noise that we were hearing. And so one of the challenges in this environment was attempting to allow data from a third party to connect to it and pass it through to another third party using our client's network as a bridge. And so again, our client being critical infrastructure, ended up having Homeland Security and having the FBI come and do some analysis. They don't communicate that kind of stuff back to us, but we did have the device. And later, you know, kind of looking around and recognized that these devices are everywhere. So what we never figured out was this a targeted attack against our client, or was this a device that our client went and picked up at Best Buy, you know, or someplace like that, or ordered it online, it got manipulated prior to being received, and then the bad guy didn't care where it went. As soon as it got plugged in, it was going to call home. And In this case, our client had a very hardened environment, and so it could not install the package that it was trying to install. And so every time it tried to, the SIM was made aware that something was happening, and that was the noise. So I suspect my reason for getting into all that, IoT, the Internet of Things, is growing rapidly. And one of the problems with Internet of Things and companies is a lot of companies want to build dashboard communication systems into the tools that they sell that go inside these SCADA environments or these ICS environments or these manufacturing environments. And they're not software developers. They build equipment, and that equipment may be sophisticated, but not going through a proper requirements definition phase, a proper change management phase, a proper production into code phase, a security testing phase. CRRT, which we didn't talk about, is cyber risk recognition testing, is the testing of Internet of Things devices for the ability to misuse that device. And so we do that. And so it's part of a system acquisition and certification step that a highly secure organization might go through if they're going to build something that gets delivered to a third party in critical infrastructure. And so understanding if these devices or these components that are part of a computer or part of a manufacturing equipment, a giant printer, a oil head unit, whatever, has these devices on them that can be exploited, I think it's absolutely a vector that, although they're not as obvious, the bad guys know about them and they know where they are and they know how to find them. And you're right. If somebody hits the right scenario, the right electric provider, the right water supply, you know, the right type of environment, it's going to be, you know, very, very painful for the people in that area that rely on whatever that producer is producing. So that IoT skirmishes, I think, is where we need to be paying attention to seeing it. And then what I talked about earlier, the work from home, work from anywhere, I think that's going to be the avenue that a lot of low-hanging fruit is going to be picked off by the bad guys, because they're going to be looking at your homes versus your corporate networks.
Okay. Now, as we our final question for this podcast, and it's probably a $60,000 question. What do you recommend people to, like, mitigate the risk from being a victim of cyber tech? What do you tell businesses? I mean, we all are at risk to becoming a victim. There's no such thing as 100% protection. So the question is, what do you tell people to mitigate that risk? What can they do to help protect themselves?
So, you know, you can't prevent somebody from throwing a bottle or a rock at you, right? But you can detect it,
right,
if you're paying attention. So I would say the majority of my clients and the people that I've ever talked to, the majority of the investment that they make in security is in products. It's in technology. And they build out the product base, the technology base, and they use it. And so they do that under the guise of protection. I want to protect my network. So for your network, it's the right thing to do, and you absolutely have to from a hygiene perspective. But you cannot protect your network all the time from everybody. So the next big bucket that people spend money on is incident response. Okay, I want to be able to respond to an incident when I'm aware of one. But guess what? If you can't detect it, you can't respond to it. So detecting it early before the bad guy did damage is much more valuable than detecting it when you've got ransomware and nobody can work. And so incident response, detection capabilities which is part of that managed cybersecurity operations center that is almost always outsourced. It is very hard to financially make the decision to invest in it and build it yourself. If you're going to run 24/7, it's going to take you at least 11 people. And so why do that, right? Hire a third party that is really good at it, and that has a staff and that has globe, which will follow the sun. They can, you know, they're 24/7, 365. They've got teams of people that can escalate a problem and can potentially jump in front of that problem and stop it and contain it before it gets out. The next level, if you have that, and if I were your CIO, I would say I want to make sure that you have a valid, tested disaster recovery plan. I want to test it, and I want to make sure that disaster recovery plan includes backups that are include off-site, offline storage, and is evaluated upon creation for encryption. Right? I want to make sure that there's no third-party encryption in my backups. In other words, did the ransomware make its way to my backup server? And now it's putting ransomware into my server backups so that I, you know, oh, wow, I got hit with ransomware. I want to be in a position to tell the ransomware bad guy, go jump in a lake, right? I'm going to go restore my system from a known good backup, and I'm going to be able to build out my system. But even better than that, I'm going to detect the presence of malware that may contain ransomware code at the first point that it is introduced into my organization, and I want to contain it and stop it and replace that machine. Right? Those are the two things that if you can do nothing else, detect with a response strategy and have a backup, a disaster recovery plan that is tested at least annually, that has a backup that is tested when it's created for encryption. If you can do those two things, you're gonna be completely different than the rest of the crowd.
Wow, excellent. Well, Jay, we thank you for your time this afternoon. It was a very enlightening show. You shed a lot of light. And I think the two big key takeaways, at least for me, was the work from home to work from anywhere, and the differentiating factor between, you know, what security is and what compliance is. Again, that's the first time I think I really ever asked that question or even thought about it. Once again, thanks for your time, and we hope to have you again in a future podcast.
Hey, well, I appreciate it very much. I hope it was valuable to the audience, and if I can ever be of assistance, please let me know. Look forward to it.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.